We are talking about the only chapter that we're going to read in this program from Love of Knowledge. We're going to switch over next time to Dynamics of Time and Space. But this chapter is a kind of transition from the last program, and I know that there are some participants who weren't in the last program, but I think it'll be pretty clear where we're going. And I tried to make it clear also in the guidance. So the basic point that this chapter is about is intentional knowledge. And intentional knowledge is the self trying to make sense out of its experience. And it does that in terms of its intentions, which is why Rinpoche calls it intentional knowledge. It sets up a structure. And in doing so, it gives priority to the future. And really the kind of key point that these chapters from Love of Knowledge are working towards is that we set up the structure of linear time with its past and its present and its future. So the past is related to what Rinpoche calls descriptive knowledge, where we identify, we describe what has showed up. So it's related to the past because it's about what has already showed up. And the future is related to the intentions of the self, which are what make our experience meaningful. And those intentions can be really any kind of intention, even just the intention to make sense out of things. But the self always has its projects and its goals. And that's what intentional knowledge is about. So at the very beginning of the chapter, at the end of the first paragraph, Rinpoche says that intentional knowledge is or could be considered more basic than descriptive knowledge. And I just wanted to take a moment to emphasize or underline that, because if we are coming from an ordinary Western understanding, a kind of a scientific understanding, and really our ordinary understanding is fundamentally grounded in science. If we're coming from that kind of an understanding, we would say descriptive knowledge is the most fundamental, because descriptive knowledge tells us what's actually there. Descriptive knowledge is about the objective world, whereas intentional knowledge is about the subjective world. And so we give priority to descriptive knowledge. But in TSK, and this is really true of certain philosophical traditions in the West, and certainly true of Buddhism also, in TSK, what you would call the subjective realm is really more basic. And we went over this in the last program, that distinction between subjective and objective already prejudges the issue. The real point is that the world that we live in and the world that we make sense out of is a world in which our experience is central. If we don't experience it, this is a little oversimplified, but if we don't experience it, it's not there. So that's where we start. So we give a very strong importance to the world that we've constructed out of our intentions. And that means that what is really central for that world is, on the one hand, you could say the future, because we're always moving toward what we're intending, what we're making sense out of. And I guess I'm realizing as I speak that, you know, there's two ways that the word intention gets used in English. One has to do with the kind of ordinary meaning of what we intend to do. You know, I intend to go to Amsterdam next week. And the other is a more technical philosophical meaning, where what we intend is just what we're aware of. And I'm kind of, I'm just realizing that I'm kind of playing on those two meanings. I didn't so much mean to. But we can stay with the ordinary meaning as much as possible. This idea that the way we make sense out of things is in terms of our projects and our goals, and therefore also in terms of our desires. And so when you focus on the future, when you focus on what you're wanting to get, then you just very naturally bring in desire also. And so it turns out that we live in a world in which the structuring element, you could say, is desire. And so what this chapter is about is, on the one hand, about why that doesn't work and what we do in response, and on the other, really trying to clarify, I think, that whole intentional structure, that desire-based structure, is all about, or is the underlying dynamic in what we think of as past and present and future. So we tend to think of past, present, future as something very neutral, something kind of boring in a sense. I mean, everybody knows about time and past, present, and future, and that linear structure. But in fact, it turns out to be very closely connected to the way that the self is making sense out of things in terms of its desires. So let me stop there and see if that's, if anybody has any questions or comments about that. Okay.
Yes, I have a question, I think.
Okay, Arthur?
Can I ask?
Yeah, of course.
When it is, it makes me a quicker sense when I try to describe something that's coming from the past. I have not so much difficulties about this, but when I try to describe what is happening, I also think it is an intentional trying. It is an intentional process. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, I think so. You're saying that excuse me.
If I try to do something, it is an intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that.
Also a description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I understand, and I think you're right. Maybe one way to think about it is to say that the content of the experience relies on descriptive knowledge, relies on our making sense out of what has shown up for us. But the very fact that we're making a description is because we're wanting something. You know, maybe we're wanting to make sense. So using descriptive knowledge is just another example of putting intentional knowledge at the center. And I suppose that's what Rinpoche means when he says that intentional knowledge is the more basic of the two. He says in that first paragraph, the content of experience is described and identified in terms of the self's concerns. And I think that's the point you're making too. So yes, I think you've got that just right. Okay, so we find ourselves in this world in which the organizing principle, you could say, is the self's desires. And what Rinpoche says about that, and I think it's really interesting, since we're still on the first page of the chapter, is he says that doesn't work. And kind of in principle it doesn't work. It's not just that sometimes we succeed in getting our desires, and then we're happy, and sometimes we don't get our desires and then we're unhappy. That's true. But he's saying something much more fundamental. He's saying that if desire, if our whole way of making sense out of the world and knowing the world, and if the kind of knowledge we're relying on is a desire-based knowledge, then, it has to be frustrating. And the reason is, he gives us a couple of different reasons, which I think are equally convincing. One is that we're always looking ahead to the future, and so we can't really enjoy the present. And, you know, one of the things Rinpoche has said sometimes, and I may have talked about it in other programs, is he said that people who get involved in spiritual things in the West for a long time have used this kind of motto, which is be here now. And he says the problem with that is that nobody understands be, and nobody understands here, and nobody understands now. And what he's doing here is talking about this notion of now. If we think of ourselves as being present in our present experience, that doesn't really make sense until we understand that the most important element in our experience is not the present, but the future. And so therefore the present that we have is kind of subordinated to the future. And that means that it's not going to be very satisfying. He says the possibility of enjoying what is already present is blocked because we're always moving ahead. We're always being driven forward by our desire, and that's where our real energy goes. So there's no opportunity to enjoy something. It's like if you're eating a piece of cake, one of my favorite examples for some reason, if you're eating a piece of cake, and you enjoyed the first piece, there is that moment when you're, or the first bite rather, there is that moment where you are enjoying it, but almost immediately you're looking ahead to having the next piece and fulfilling that desire for the next piece because the last piece, you describe it to yourself, was so good. And because that's so, it turns out you really don't enjoy the second bite at all. We're nowhere near as much because you're caught up in this structure of moving ahead into the future and you lose track of the present. You have no real access to the present. You really, the self takes possession of experience from the future. And yet the problem is that the future isn't really there, so the self isn't really there, so it's not in the present, it's not in the future, it's not in the past. There's another place in Love of Knowledge where Rinpoche says it's spread out among present, past and present and future. But what happens is you don't get the opportunity to be present to your own experience or even to know in any very satisfying way what's going on in the future. And then he makes a second argument, which is just that when you form a desire, the desired object exists in the future. And so if, in fact, you get it in the present, even though we may not be very clear what that means, but if you get it in the present, it's not the same thing you were desiring. So, sometimes we desire something and we get it and we really enjoy it tremendously. And that's fine. That's an example of the present really taking on some life. But in the next moment, we're moving on to the future. And very often it happens that we don't even enjoy that moment of getting because what we're getting is not what we thought we were going to get. And for a little while, we're confused about that, and we tell ourselves that it's just exactly what we wanted. And then suddenly we realize, well, wait a minute, this isn't exactly what I had in mind. So the summary statement of that on page 156, which is one of these really powerful statements in Love of Knowledge, is Rinpoche says, tightly bound by yesterday, swept along into tomorrow, the self is cut off from its world, stranded and isolated. Its ways of knowing foster not knowing, its ways of fulfillment result in frustration. The self lives in the present like a traveler in an inhospitable foreign land, ill at ease, unsure of how to act, never really at home with its experience. I love that description. Because it seems to me to capture something really important about this underlying frustration that we feel. And the sense that most of us are familiar with, maybe we don't have it all the time, but at least some of the time we have this sense that things just aren't right, that somehow we're being cheated out of what it seems like we ought to be able to enjoy. And here Rinpoche is tying that into a particular kind of knowledge, and more specifically to this particular structure of time, which is based on, ultimately, on intentional knowledge and also descriptive knowledge. okay, let me stop there again. See if that, does that make sense to people? Sometimes I feel like, you know, people may be saying to themselves, that's just too negative. You know, I enjoy my experience. Does anybody want to take that stand? Or ask any questions? Or is everybody completely convinced? Okay.
Yeah.
You're easy. You're an easy audience. Okay.
I want a way out, though. I do.
You want a way out? Yeah. Right. Well, that's where we're headed. Actually, not. We're going to explore some of the possible ways out. We don't really get to talk about a way out for a while yet. I mean, in the program, we will be moving in that direction for sure. So the first way out that is discussed then in this chapter is that we are just going to enjoy our inward feelings and emotions. So the idea here is, in a sense, we just rely on subjective reality. And in the last program, if you go back and look at chapter 5 of Love of Knowledge, there's that wonderful discussion of the subjective and the objective realms, and how it undermines our ability to know and to enjoy, to make that distinction into the subjective and objective realms. But here we are, having made that distinction, and we say, okay, what really matters is how I feel about things. It doesn't matter what's going on in the world. I have my feelings, you know, and if I'm enjoying myself, then that's all I could ever really ask for. And the problem with that is it doesn't really get you very far. As he says at the bottom of page 156, feelings and emotions remain bound to the future-centered structure of intentional knowledge. And in fact, they are the subjective expression of the patterns of desire and longing, working themselves out through time. So you start off and you have this desire, and as a result of having the desire, you have a certain feeling, and you can kind of enjoy that feeling. And there's this wonderful image that Rinpoche uses at the top of page 157. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like I'm just a fan club for the book, but there are so many wonderful things in this book. The image he uses of an old dog, I think the idea here is that the dog is so old that it's lost all its teeth, and it's chewing on this bone, and the bone has no meat on it, but it's a sharp bone, and so it cuts the dog's gums, and so the dog tastes its own blood and says, oh, what a nice juicy piece of meat. Which is kind of sad. So that's what it's like. I mean, that's his image for what it's like to rely on desires, or on feelings, rather. We have this desire, and it awakens a certain feeling in us, and then we suck on that feeling. We saw, let's say, how wonderful, how nourishing. But in fact, we haven't gotten any closer to the real experience. So there's a shift, as he says right at the bottom of 156. He says, we shift from what is desired to the longing or the satisfaction that desire brings in its wake. So it doesn't really even matter what we desire so much. I mean, that's up to descriptive knowledge, and who cares, really, as long as we get this nice, juicy feeling as a result of either anticipating that the desire will be fulfilled, or at least in that first moment when the desire is fulfilled. It turns out that when we're in that situation, we're just confined to our own little subjective world. This is something, and this is so characteristic of our culture in a way. I don't think it's as true in other cultures. But in our culture, it's like, as long as you have good feelings, you know, that's the only thing that counts. And you might think of that in terms of something that has always struck me as really interesting, is the way people go places and take photographs. They take the photographs, and maybe somebody will disagree with this, but my analysis is that they take the photographs so that they can have the feelings, or at least have a memory of the feeling that they had when they were there. But because they're busy taking photographs, they really don't have much of a feeling when they're there. And so you wind up trying to capture this likeness of your experience instead of just having the experience. And because you're busy trying to capture it, you don't even have the experience. Kodak used to run ads that were based entirely on that idea. It was something, I don't remember what their slogan was, but it was something like, "We give you good memories," or something. And you know, it's as though the memory is really better than the actual thing, because now you can just suck on that same feeling over and over again. It's sad. Okay. So we're more and more cut off from reality. You know, we've adopted this structure of linear time. We focus on the future, and the result is that we don't, in a very deep sense, we don't know what's going on. You know, we only know our desire and our subjective reactions to our desire. So this would actually be a good point to ask. I suggested in the essay for this week that people might like to work with the object of desire practice that's at the end of this chapter. Did anybody do that who would like to say something about it?
Yes, I did it, Arthur, and I did it, but I think it would be better for me to write a mail. So I think it is a little bit difficult.
Okay, so you want to post something about it.
I think it can be written in words better.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's great. By the way, that reminds me that I should apologize. As you know, I'm in Germany now and I'm teaching a retreat, and I just didn't have the chance to look at people's comments this first week, and so I didn't comment either to look at what people posted. Next week, although I'm still teaching, I think it will be a little easier. My schedule will be easier, so I should have a chance to do that. But I didn't this week, so people may have posted wonderful things and I didn't hear them. I'm sorry, or didn't read them rather.
I did practice a little bit, John.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't get much of an effect, but I got a little glimmer of how paying attention to the process of desiring. Especially if the desire sort of like really relates to what we think is significant in our life, and maybe involves happiness to other people, then the practice can get you kind of situating yourself in the future, looking back a little bit, and then kind of, instead of just being this toothless dog kind of person trying to luxuriate and imagine pleasures in the future, you kind of look ahead in a way that relates to your situation now, and it can kind of affect, well, I would like to act this way rather than another.
Mm-hmm.
The image of the toothless dog suggests maybe we could get teeth somehow, and the feelings themselves maybe aren't bogus, we just picked the wrong object for them or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's interesting. I don't know about the last thing you said, that maybe if we picked a different object, it would turn out differently. I'm not so sure about that. But I do think that part of the structure of intentional knowledge that always pushes us into the future is that it also focuses us a lot on the object of desire. So there's the object of desire, and then there's our subjective reaction. And one way to work with this exercise would be to focus more on the feeling of desire, which is a little different from the feeling of anticipating a desire that's fulfilled. It's just the actual feeling of desire itself. And in a way, not paying so much attention to what the object of the desire is. If you were going in that direction, it seems like even though you're still within that structure of desire, you're getting closer to the reality of the experience, which is the desire itself, not whatever it projects, but the desire itself. So it sounds like you were going in that direction, and that seems like it could be valuable. So, okay. So, the focus, you know, that's a possibility to focus on feeling. And I do want to just acknowledge that there are some things, that the word feeling in English is very imprecise. And there's some things that we call feelings that really might connect us much more with the present. And I guess, Michael, you hinted at that. In what you described, for instance, the feeling of love can connect us to our experience in a way that doesn't seem to be bound to intentional and descriptive knowledge. It's something much bigger. You know, if you think about linear time as one-dimensional, I think it's a very good image. I mean, it clearly is one-dimensional. There's, you know, past, present, and future unfold along a line. And that image is a good image because it suggests that you, there's not much that you can squeeze into the experience, as it were, because it's just this little line, you know. There's no volume, there's no dimension, there's nothing there to really experience or enjoy. And something like love, or, you know, I'm thinking now of these immeasurable feelings as they're described in Buddhism, which are love and joy and equanimity and compassion, they open up that other dimension. And so they kind of burst out of the temporal structure of desire. So there are those kinds of feelings. That's not exactly what we're dealing with now. So I just wanted to make sure, I want to kind of give love its due, you know, and give compassion its due. They're good. We like them. Okay. So, in terms of knowledge, you know, we're looking now at how this is all very frustrating and not at all satisfying, and the self is just, you know, lives in a, as it says, as in that passage that we read, you know, it lives in an uneasy way. It doesn't know how to act. It never really feels at home. But if we focus on the knowledge side, because part of what the TSK vision is about is what happens, what kind of new knowledge becomes available if our experience of time and space is different. So if we focus on the knowledge side, the short thing to say, the quick thing to say, is that the kind of knowledge that's available in that situation, it really doesn't count as knowledge at all. We just have our emotionality, we just have our desires, we just have our frustrations, we just have our feelings. There's really no possibility for clarity. And I think in part that leads to the other point, the other approach that Rinpoche talks about in this chapter, which is, you know, we realize that we're not getting anywhere by just kind of sucking on our feelings. The other alternative relates to what was described earlier in the book as technological knowledge. And basically, technological knowledge has to do with control. Yes, we want to satisfy the desires of the self, but we're going to do that by controlling the reality that we find ourselves in. And that at least has the advantage, I guess you could say, that it exercises a certain kind of knowledge. You know, we're intent on figuring out how to get what we want, and that brings with it a certain kind of clarity. So it's a clarity that's directed as mastery, at mastery, as Rinpoche says on 159. You know, that's, you get logic, you get measurement, you get machinery, you get these things that are putting into service, the service of desire, this capacity that we have for being clear. But what Rinpoche says, and you know, maybe people have something to say about that, but he says that still doesn't get away from the fact that you're subordinating the possibilities for knowledge and the possibilities for experience to this intentional structure of desire. You're trying to satisfy your desires, and you're developing a certain clarity about how to do that. But in fact, what you wind up doing is confirming this past, present, future structure, and you even make it in some ways more rigid, because this is where you get the whole tendency to think of time as something that's measured out, you know, 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 second, and so forth. And you really stop paying any attention to the what time presents. Oh, I'm still there. Am I still there?
Yes.
Good? Okay. You stop paying attention to what time presents and just focus on this measured out version of time. And that makes it even more difficult to get in touch with your experience, you know, because now you're thinking about this present moment, which is too small to contain anything. And Rinpoche makes an interesting point toward the bottom of page 159. He says, the endless segments of a technologically measured out time seem to disperse and to diffuse the self's energy. So there's an impact not only on our ability to know and our ability to enjoy, but it also cuts off our energy. We've lost contact with who and what we are, and so we can't bring any intensity to bear. So it's a pretty bad situation, and that's pretty much where we end up in this chapter. I'll read the end of it just because, again, it's a really lovely description, even though it's a depressing one. He says, time is measured out in advance, like a desert tracked with endless footprints. There may be discipline, but it leads nowhere. There may be creativity, but it is channeled into rigid routines. Even when the promised results are attained, no satisfaction can be found. So, what can we do about it? Well, that's where we're going to start to head next week, and to switch a little bit to the language of dimensions, the dynamics of time and space, we don't have to accept the past, present, future structure. We can conduct time differently. You know, we have this dimension of this linear dimension of description and intention, but that's just one way of conducting time. And as we'll see, that verb conducting plays a pretty important role in making sense of what Rinpoche says about that in dynamics. So that's where we're going to go next week. I was going to suggest, and I'll put this in the reading also, there is something that is actually comes a little later in the reading in dynamics. It's an exercise that's not a formal exercise. It's just a part of the text of dynamics. And it's on page 99, I believe. I always do that from memory, but I can actually look it up here. But it has to do with the idea of, it's on page 99, the very last paragraph. And he says, one way to open up the dimension of the future is one way to come in contact with its dynamic is to touch its aliveness by going to the point at which the future arises. So that's the last paragraph on page 99. You might look at that and try that out as an exercise, or just try it out as something to do in the middle of your experience. As you know, I like to encourage us to do exercises that we can do just in our everyday life, and this is something you could do really at any time once you get familiar with it. So the last paragraph of page 99. And I'll put that in the guidance essay, which I will post hopefully by tomorrow morning, Pacific Coast time. That's my plan. Okay, anything else? Good. And we'll talk next week. I'll be in Amsterdam next week.